I said, anybody who goes to a James Bond movie, just bring me your ticket stub, because I consider it an operational expense and I'll reimburse you.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. After service in the US Army during the Vietnam War, Bob Wallace was recruited into the Central Intelligence Agency. In the CIA, his initial assignments were as a field case officer. He rose through the ranks at the agency and was chief of station in three locations where he directed the full range of CIA activities. In 1995, Bob became deputy director of the Office of Technical Service, and in 1998 was appointed its director, responsible for creating spy devices and capabilities necessary to conduct clandestine operations with safety and security. In other words, Bob was the Q of CIA. Now, this podcast relies on listener support to enable me to continue to capture these incredible stories and make them available for everyone for free. I could really use your support to help me to find the time and to finance the preservation of these Cold War histories. And you can do that via one-off or monthly donations.
This is Mark. I support the Cold War Conversations podcast because this is fantastic history, textured, in-depth, real stories of a defining period in our history.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more details. You can also join our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Bob Wallace to our Cold War conversation.
When I was discharged from the Army, an honorable discharge, I would note, Ian, just in case you were wondering.
I never had any doubts, Bob. I had no doubts.
My Army career was 21 months and 12 days, but I wasn't counting too closely. Two things about the Army career that I'll sum up. One, I knew that the Army life, military service as a career, was not for me. Secondly, I came away with a level of respect for those who are part of the military that I would have never have had otherwise. So now I'm out of the Army and I need a job. While at Fort Hood, a couple of months before I was discharged, it occurred to me that I might need a job. And when I got out, in part because I was going to get married in August, and there was a book at Fort Hood in the library that said Careers in America. And it listed companies and organizations by alphabet: Abbott Laboratories, Burlington Northern Railroad, Central Intelligence Agency, Data General, you know, Eaton Corporation, those kinds of listings. And so I wrote a whole bunch of letters to these places asking what their job possibilities were. One of the responses that I received was from the CIA. Now, you know, I'm an educated guy. I have a master's degree in political science. I'd served in Vietnam. I had almost no knowledge about the CIA, but the letter was intriguing, and they said, we have a recruiter in Austin, Texas, which is an hour and a half drive from Fort Hood, and our man there would be happy to talk with you. So on one Saturday, I drove down to Austin. There was a very nice anti-war demonstration going on at the University of Texas campus. And so I went over and kind of hung around there to see what was going on. And afterwards, kept my 1 o'clock appointment with Bill Wood, Mr. Wood, the recruiter. So he told me about this place called the CIA and that they might be interested in me, and just kind of did a general interview, which concluded with him saying, "Well, I'll write this up and I'll send it in, and if you hear from us, you'll hear from us. If you don't, you won't." Kind of thing. I never really thought much about it until a couple of months later at the farm. I got a letter from the CIA that said, "Come to Washington for interviews in September, October. So I looked at that. I said, "Well, this is pretty interesting." One, I wanted to go to Washington anyway. I had decided that that was a place where I was going to go. I was intrigued by Washington, having visited it as a college junior several years earlier. Said, this is a place I might kind of like to live. Plus, I was interested in politics. And I said, "I'll bet I can get a job with up on Capitol Hill." Again, I know nothing about this. I have no contacts up there. Just, I got married. Mary Margaret and I got married in August, and so we used the per diem and the advance that we received from the CIA that I was going there to be interviewed. We used that to fund our trip to Washington and our first month's rent at an apartment in Washington. I was interviewed a CIA. They said, "Yeah, we might be interested in," and again, "go away, and we'll let you know." The job that I did manage to get was with a congressman from Ohio on Capitol Hill, so I had income and was working for the congressman. When I get then a third letter from the CIA that says, "Congratulations, we have you are offered a job in our professional career training program, and you can start in January as a GS-10. That was about $2,000 a year more than I was making for the congressman. So, hey, how hard a decision is that for a young guy that's just married and needs money? So I'm telling this story to say that some people who join the CIA join the CIA because they really want to be involved in American intelligence. I'm afraid if I told the truth, I'd have to say I joined the CIA because, yeah, it offered more money than the job that I was doing at the time. But the good news is that I then got a fourth letter from the CIA about a week before I was to start there and said, "We have good news for you. You have been promoted." we have reassessed our hiring standards, and because you have a master's degree, you can join the CIA not as a GS-10 but as a GS-11. So I made another $1,500 a year before I ever joined. That, I have to say, was the easiest promotion I ever received during my career. So then January of 1990. I'm at CIA in the training program at the agency. I had no idea that I would be there, 33 years later.
And what was that training program like? What were they training you in?
The training program consisted of, because it was called the professional career training program, it was designed for future officers who would have a broad perspective of the agency's mission and capabilities in the anticipation that that this cadre of people would be among the future leadership of the organization. So we had operational training. We had training in analysis, analytical work. We had exposure to the support networks, the administrative networks of the agency over a period of about 1 year. At the end of the year, we were then assigned to, or in agency parlance, picked up by one of the operating components of the agency. The component I was picked up by was called the Domestic Contact Service. It was an organization that both collected intelligence and provided operational support to espionage operations overseas.
When you say operational training, is that to the lengths of tradecraft or anything like that, or what is that?
Yes, when I refer to operational training, I'm really referring to training in clandestine operations. So this was the full suite of training that exposed you to surveillance, counter surveillance, dead drops, elicitation, recruitment, use of spy gadgets, spy techniques, all of the things that one would do if one were running human agent operations, clandestine human agent operations anywhere in the world.
And so I presume as part of that training, they set you tasks where you had to carry out the methods you've been trained in to, you know, complete a mock mission of some kind.
Yes, there were a whole series of training exercises conducted by senior operations officers, people who had done it, just like in the Army, you're trained by soldiers who have been in combat. While in the CIA, you're trained by officers who have run espionage, clandestine operations worldwide. You're also trained by technical officers who know how gadgets work and how those can be deployed and used. These exercises are rigorous. They are evaluated. There is no hesitancy to tell someone if they're not cutting the mustard, so to speak, that they're just not the right caliber for this kind of work. So it again put me back into a situation of having experiences that I had never before contemplated being part of.
Can you describe what you mean by that?
Well, the idea that someone would recruit and then handle a spy clandestinely, securely, in an environment where there is a counterintelligence service that is trying to find out what you are doing or who the spy is. These are activities where you are putting a person's future both. His or her life potentially at risk. These spies are violating the laws of the country in which they are spying, and it must be done clandestinely, or the consequences are severe.
In the early 1970s, what sort of gadgets were you using then?
The ability to run clandestine operations, the CIA had learned because of failures during the 1950s and the 1960s would increasingly need to be done with technology, or technology became a critical part of how such operations were run. perhaps the most famous, historically famous of CIA agents was Oleg Penkovsky. Oleg Penkovsky was a senior official in the Soviet government in the late 50s and early 60s, who decided that he opposed the Soviet system and was recruited, jointly recruited by the British and the Americans to provide information at the highest level of the Soviet government. Think the National Security Council in terms of the United States. So the CIA, British, now had a source who operated within the National Security Council of the Soviet government in the late 50s and early 60s. Penkovsky provided information for us, for the United States, that allowed President Kennedy sufficient confidence to confront the Soviets with a blockade of Cuba after the Soviets had introduced nuclear weapons into Cuba. The Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 was resolved because President Kennedy had sufficient confidence, intelligence and confidence in the intelligence that he could put a blockade around Cuba and the Soviets would not attempt to break that blockade militarily. They would find a way to back away from the confrontation. Kennedy's ability to do that is heavily dependent on the reporting that Oleg Penkovsky provided. The bad news is that Oleg Penkovsky was compromised, and Oleg Penkovsky was arrested and executed in 1963. And so with that, we lost perhaps the best agent we've ever had in the Soviet Union, a man who has been called an agent who saved the world. The analysis of the loss of that agent by the CIA led to a conclusion that we were deficient in three areas. The first area was we did not have a capability to give an agent a camera that they could photograph documents, that they could photograph information without being detected. The second was we didn't have sufficient confidence in our ability to evade Russian or Soviet surveillance when we were doing operations. So if our officer was under surveillance, they didn't know whether or not when they could potentially safely meet an agent. Were they under surveillance or not? And the third was we had no ability to communicate securely with our agent, with Penkovsky, without meeting him in person. So those three areas became the focus of the technology development of the 1960s, which goes to the point, to the question you ask, what were the technologies of the 1970s that were particularly important. The first was the development of a small sub-miniature camera that was known as the T-100. The T-100 was a camera the size of the last joint of your pinky finger. And that camera, with its 7 or 8 intricate lenses, was able to be concealed in all types of non-alerting common items that an individual would carry, such as a fountain pen or a cigarette lighter. And then this camera then could effectively photograph documents without the agent being detected that he was taking pictures. The second device that was developed was the small cigarette pack size unit that could be worn on a person under concealed in a person's armpit with a non-wire transmit capability to an earphone. The device itself intercepted Soviet surveillance communications. So an officer, our officer, was listening to what the Soviet counterintelligence officers who were trailing, who were monitoring, were telling each other. So our officer would know exactly where those officers were, where his surveillance might be, and that would give him the opportunity to evade it. The third device was a communications system that enabled the agent and the case officer, our officer, to exchange up to 256 characters of information over a radio link, a radio frequency, at about a distance of a quarter of a mile. This was really the world's first text messaging system, and enabled us never to have to be in the same place at the same time as an agent. So these three technologies combined have been characterized, and I don't think unfairly, as the technologies that won the Cold War in terms of the intelligence sense.
Right, and the camera you described, the T-100, that was still film, wasn't it? It wasn't digitalized in any way.
Yes, Ian, the T-100 was a film camera. It had a very small strip of film that was no more than 5 inches long and could take up to 100 images on that strip of film. The images that were sufficiently clear that they were documents, so you could read words on words of documents, or you could photograph drawings. You asked the question. I'm smiling as we are talking, because when I give presentations to college classes now, I always take along a roll of film with me to demonstrate what film is when I use the word.
Yeah, that's why I was asking. I mean, I know what film is, but some of our listeners might just think there's a chip in it or something like that.
To add to that, now the CIA once it had developed this really effective sub-miniature camera. At the same time, I was very aware of other digital technologies that were rapidly coming into the fore. So in the early 80s, the agency undertook a project to develop a digital camera. And in fact, by 1990, could fairly be called the first workable digital camera that an individual could carry and use.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
deployed that, developed that for our agents. And the digital camera not only had all of the characteristics of what we now know as commercial digital cameras, but it was a camera that also could transmit the data, the digital data that it had, and transmit it in an encrypted sense. So it wasn't exactly the camera that is in your iPhone 12, but it had many of those same characteristics. It was obviously primitive and all that by standards today, but it was incredibly effective, and we deployed this to our absolute best agents we had in all of the difficult areas around the world.
Yeah, because that obviously removed the need for a dead drop.
Yes, it did, and it also reduced the amount of stuff, the amount of spy gear an individual had to have. So all of those things play into the security of an operation.
What was your first field assignment?
My field assignments, I had five field assignments, all of them in U.S. stations, U.S. based stations. That was just one of the quirks of fate for my particular assignments, and I first went to Minneapolis, assigned to the office we had in Minneapolis, and eventually ended up as the chief of station in Los Angeles. That was my fifth of the field assignments. During those field assignments, we had multiple responsibilities. The domestic contact service later became known as the Domestic Contact Division, and ultimately the National Resources Division, same organization, just different names, had a history that goes back before the CIA. After the Second World War, before the CIA was formed in 1947, there were people who recognized that the need for foreign intelligence collection remain despite the fact that the war was over. And so a small unit was set up in New York, which had the responsibility for contacting and debriefing primarily New York-based businessmen who were involved in international trade, economics, technology. They were involved with foreign counterparts, companies, and individuals from which information could be obtained that would be important to the intelligence community. So this office was established in 1946 and then absorbed into the CIA in 1947 with the establishment of the agency. The activity of that office in terms of voluntary debriefings of American businessmen, scientists, citizens of all type who had access to foreign information of use to the intelligence community, that debriefing activity continued and continues today. The offices also, stations also had the responsibility for the resettlement of defectors or agents who the CIA would bring back into the United States after their time of service had been ended. It had responsibility for the collection of certain types of foreign materials that primarily had value to the U.S. Military, pieces of foreign equipment, manuals, operating instructions for foreign weapon systems. And we had responsibility for providing operational support to clandestine operations overseas, sometimes that involved cover. Sometimes that involved logistics, the variety of things that an operation might need to be done clandestinely in other places in the world.
And were you involved in counterintelligence work as well?
Within the United States, the counterintelligence responsibilities all lies with the FBI. So in the course of our work, we would at times come across information that would have a counterintelligence angle to it. We work very closely with the local foreign counterintelligence officers, agents within the FBI to ensure that that information was passed along to the appropriate people. We have no investigative authorities, CIA officers. CIA has no domestic law enforcement responsibilities or investigative authorities. That all resides with the FBI.
And are there any particularly memorable incidents that you can remember during your field assignments?
Every day when I got up, I could say, you know, I have a chance to make a difference. What we're doing, either personally or our station, we have a chance to make a difference for American intelligence. One day, I had a meeting with the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, a big name, major company. And it was a late afternoon meeting, maybe 5 o'clock, and I had been talking to him because of some work he was doing in the Far East, some work that the company was doing in the Far East, and some access that they had to technologies that we thought were being used or that were being used for military applications. We had this very nice conversation. He gave me some excellent information along that line, and I was about ready to leave, and he said, by the way, do you know that the president, meaning the U.S. president, is meeting with such and such a leader tomorrow? And I said, yeah, you know, I'd seen that. This executive CEO said to me, well, you want to know what they, meaning the other person, you want to know what the other person is going to bring up with the president? And I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, you know, I have this really, really nice report that I just received from our guy, you know, in the particular country that it was involved, he's a good friend with a person on the leader's staff, and he said, here's the six things that the leader is going to raise with the U.S. president. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, and you know, he hands me this piece of paper, and yeah, all these, you know, these six things are written there. And I said, you're kidding me. No, he said, you know, my guy knows these folks real well. And I said, well, you know, excuse me, thank you. I think I need to get back to my office right away. And so I went back, and we immediately wrote a report and put it on the highest priority transmission possible back to Washington, that was delivered to the president later in the evening, and then the response we got back subsequently was, well, thank you very much. This is exactly the 6 points that was raised with the president, and he was ready to address each one of them. So that was, you know, these are the highlights. It doesn't happen every day, but there were enough significant events like this to just say how what a privilege it was to be able to contribute to American policy like this.
Yeah, yeah. So these senior executives in these businesses weren't technically agents, but they were sort of your eyes and ears in certain aspects or certain areas of the world. Is that how it worked?
Well, yes, they were all men and women that we would approach, we would contact, and say, you know, we have particular interests in this particular subject, and because of either who you are as a person or because of your company. You would have access to information in these specific areas, and if you're willing, we would like to talk with you about that. We'd like to debrief you on those occasions when you can support us with this information. There were a couple things that are really important here. Again, we have no law enforcement investigative authorities, so when we show up, we would make that absolutely clear that this is completely voluntary. They were under no obligation in any way to continue to assist us when we had individuals who would say no, I would prefer not to do that. You know, that we went away and respected that completely. We did not engage in subterfuge with any such individuals. And I would say, Ian, that the contribution of the citizen to American intelligence is perhaps one of the most I don't call it underrated, but it is one of the least known values that this country has received from its citizens. The Revolutionary War, you know, many of George Washington's best sources were just average citizens. They helped when they could, and then they went back to their regular business. This is the same way. Citizen sources are men and women who help when they can, where they can, and then return to their regular activities. Just a remarkable sense and evidence of patriotism that I experienced throughout my career.
Were you running any agents at all?
I was supporting agents that were being run, or supporting officers who were running agents, I think would be the best way to put it. So my involvement would be as needed, when needed, where needed.
Can you remember hearing the news of the Berlin Wall opening, Bob?
The Berlin Wall, the arrest of Aldrich Ames, the attempted coup in 1991 in which Yeltsin prevailed. You know, those are all 9/11, the arrest of Robert Hansen. These are the kinds of events, world events and intelligence events that absolutely stick in one's mind. The Berlin Wall, I think, was a stunning surprise, not only to the world, but to many people within the intelligence community. It wasn't a surprise that there was a substantial unrest and dissatisfaction throughout the Eastern European countries that followed on Gorbachev and his Glasnost kind of policy, that the chains that the Soviets had over the East European countries seemingly were rusting, were weakening, were were being severed, but the drama of the Berlin Wall is simply unforgettable to any who saw it. I only regret that I wasn't there to view it in person.
It was an amazing time. And you mentioned Hansen and Ames. What was the reaction internally in the CIA when news of those cases surfaced?
Internally, the counterintelligence people at CIA knew that there was a major leak. There was a major problem. There was a major compromise. We had lost too many agents and too many operations as a result. That investigation, though properly so, had been kept very quiet. And I believe I was in Bogota when the word came across our system that this person Ames had Aldrich Ames had been arrested. Is there a sense of unbelief? You know, sort of unbelief, but I think those in the profession also understand that the opposition services, the adversaries are always very active, and the likelihood of their being able to recruit somebody within your service, you can't miss that. This is why you practice compartmentation of your sensitive information. So if you lose something, if you lose some, you don't lose everything. The Aldrich Ames, I think, struck a lot of people because he was a well-known figure at CIA headquarters, and just the reality that the Soviet intelligence service at the KGB could have gotten that far inside the CIA's most sensitive compartments was a stunning revelation. I think we reacted in shock.
I can imagine. I can imagine. Now, with most of my interviews, I stop with people's careers at the end of the Cold War, but I really can't miss out talking to you about your role as director of the CIA's Office of Technical Service. Can you just describe what that role entails and how you arrived there?
The Office of Technical Service at CIA was that unit responsible for the development and deployment of all of the spy gadgets that agents would use. So the Office of Technical Service did the things like miniature cameras, they did surveillance equipment, they did disguises, they did, we don't like to call it forgeries, we would rather say reproductions. We did special weapons. We did the agent communication systems. So all of those gadgets that were developed for agents being used in the field was the responsibility of the OTS. Some have said OTS is America's Q, and there is some. Some accuracy to that in terms of relationship to the James Bond movies. Now, I am not an engineer. I'm not a technician. I'm a political science guy. I'm a liberal arts person. So the question is, why would the agency be so stupid as to put somebody like you in charge of the Office of Technical Service? And I have asked myself that question. In fact, when I was first told by the deputy director for operations that he would like me to apply for the position as deputy director of the Office of Technical Service. I served first as deputy and then subsequently as director. That was exactly my question. Why me? I don't even change the oil in my car. And his response was one of those kind of memorable ones, and some might say foolish, but memorable to me. He said, "Bob, I've known you long enough to know that you don't have any technical bone in your body, but you do understand operations, and you do understand the importance of clandestinity and the importance of gadgets in running secure operations. I'm sending you over there. I want you to go over there because I figure that any gadget that office develops and you can work and you can make it work. If you can make it work, Bob, I figure any agent anywhere in the world can make it work. So that's what your job is. I want you to deliver only things that will really work in the real world for our real agents." So, Ian, that was kind of my charge when I was there. I didn't pretend to be an engineer. I didn't pretend to be a scientist or a technical officer. But I did try to insist that anything that we deploy in the field, it be understandable enough and simple enough that even Bob Wallace can operate it.
So a little bit of a backhanded compliment for you, Bob, wasn't it?
Well, I think so. And I think the real adjustment was for the folks at the Office of Technical Service. And I hope over the years this happened, that they understood I wasn't there, and my management role, I wasn't there to tell them how to do their job. I wasn't there to tell them, you know, what frequency was the best frequency. I wasn't there to tell them what size of box was necessary. I wasn't there to tell them that this piece of material won't work in this kind of a disguise. I was there to encourage them to use their best imagination and best creativity they had, and then look at the product and say, "Yeah, you know, this works for me. I think this is going to work well for our agents."
And when you said special weapons, what sort of can you describe what you mean by that?
The agency, going back really to its OSS history, has supported paramilitary operations. And in the course of those paramilitary operations, there are sometimes requirements for special capabilities, either in terms of explosives or a particular type of a gun or a particular type of detection equipment that would be used in combat paramilitary kinds of operations. One of the I use a term weapons fairly loosely because what I mean is that a whole suite of capabilities that a special operations officer might want to have. So during the Vietnam War, for example, we built and we configured some very high speed boats, craft, to appear as Chinese junks that could operate up and down the coast of Vietnam. And these junks, if needed, could quickly rid themselves of their junk camouflage, and on the boats would be a high speed craft with appropriate 50 caliber or other weaponry that could engage as necessary. So those are the kinds of things that we did with the special weapons.
Now, I know that Warsaw Pact countries were quite common in using number stations to communicate to their agents in place. Did the CIA use number stations for communication?
The CIA used the whole suite of various communications that were available to them. High frequency communications became common during the Second World War, and continued to be used through my career. Now the problem with the number stations always had to do with kind of the agent had to receive, and then it had to the agent had to decode the numbers. Increasingly, those processes became more and more automated, but it was still comparatively to some of the things that you can do on the internet, it was complicated for the agent to use, cumbersome for the agent to use. One of the kind of neat things about number stations, though, is that they're relatively inexpensive to continue these broadcasts. And from the standpoint of counterintelligence, if you are monitoring a whole series of number stations broadcasts coming into your country, you have no idea whether these are real or are these chaff. Are they actually broadcasting to real agents, or are they just, you know, throwing stuff out over the air? So it has a number stations have something of a very effective, say, confusing role to play in intelligence.
So you can make a country think there's agents in place when there isn't, just by
they just don't know. They just don't know. You've got all these broadcasts coming in, and you know, do they have any meaning or not? It's virtually impossible to determine, because you don't know the footprint of the broadcast coming in is so wide. You have no idea where it might be received, being received, or whether it's maybe not being received at all.
Of all the gadgets you came across during your time with the CIA, what was your favorite one?
My favorite gadget falls kind of into two different categories. One is the category for deception, and one is the category for actually collecting valuable information. In terms of the deception, my favorite is the Jack in the Box. The Jack in the Box is a pop-up mannequin that officers could that would be concealed in a briefcase, and officers could take that, have that in their car if they wanted to confuse, or if they wanted to deceive, the counterintelligence as to how many people were in an automobile. This was used first in the Soviet Union, in which two officers would be in a car when their car would quickly round a corner and to be temporarily out of sight of the surveillance that was trailing them. The officer in the passenger side would roll out of the car, and the device, the Jack in the Box, would immediately be popped up. So there was just that 3 or 4 seconds of invisibility between the car with our officers and the surveillance people. And during that few seconds, our officer could get out and then head to a meeting. He would be black, head to a meeting with an agent. And all the trailing surveillance would see would be the silhouette of still two people in the automobile as it continued on. So the Jack in the Box was a terrific deception device. In terms of the collection, I think one of the most important pieces of equipment we had was a handheld I'm going to call it a GPS device. As the GPS became available and reliable, we developed a tracking capability that an agent could carry, and we did this in Afghanistan. A tracking agent could carry this device, and at various points during their recon in Afghanistan, they could trigger the device and establish then specific waypoints where either facilities or people of interest would be located. This information could be immediately then acted on by reactive forces.
Fascinating. Now, Bob, you're also the co-author of a number of spy books. I think there's a couple that are spy books that concentrate on locations in the US of particular spy cases. There's Spy Sites of New York City, and I think there's Spy Sites of Philadelphia as well.
Yes, Ian. We did, beginning in 2015, began a series of Spy Sites books. We did Spy Sites of Washington, D.C., Spy Sites of New York, and most recently, Spy Sites of Philadelphia. And what we've tried to do in these three books is identify key locations where espionage operations occurred in the United States or where significant people in the United States lived, worked, played, sometimes slept, sometimes died, all of these aspects that go into espionage activities. And we were not aware, we didn't believe anybody had tried to create something of a history of American espionage by looking at the locations. And collectively, that's what these three books give the reader a sense of America's espionage history through locations. So you can visit places. These are places that you can visit. You can stand there. Some of them are the original structures. Some of them are not. But you can actually stand in the place where real spies did their operations. You can walk the paths that real spies walked. You can go to sites where real spies put down dead drops. You can see the location where a real spy was arrested. All of those things are in these series of Spy Sites books. I'll just add one piece, because this is we're talking about Philadelphia and the founding of America. What we make the point in Spy Sites of Philadelphia is that our founding fathers, before they were these statesmen, our historical statesmen, our great men of America, before they were the founding fathers, they were really a gang of spies. And in 1774 and 1775, the first thing that our founding fathers did was to set up an intelligence apparatus and capability under George Washington, and make sure that he had the funds to run intelligence operations. Washington is, I think, properly credited with saying that really it was the intelligence apparatus, largely based on citizen spies, but also because of the foresight of the founding fathers, that gave him the advantage and ultimate victory over the British.
Yeah, we tend to like to forget that over here, but it's a very valid piece of history. And you're absolutely right. And I think certainly people in the UK are less aware of that.
Now, if I could make just a one final comment on that. Our spy sites of Philadelphia book and New York as well, because those were the two key cities during the Revolutionary War in America. I think we pay proper respect to some of the British spy operations that were occurring during the same time. So in no way have we neglected, I believe, to recognize that the professional intelligence officers from Major Andre through General Howe, they were brilliant professionals as well. And this was not a war that was, how would I say, easily decided. I am delighted that in the 21st century, we are close allies. I would make a point in terms of the gadgets. And this really, again, is a tip of my hat to all of you who claim the Britain as home. I love the James Bond movies, and I love the Q part of the James Bond movies. In fact, when I was director of the Office of Technical Service, I said, anybody who goes to a James Bond movie, just bring me your ticket receipt, your ticket stub, because I consider it an operational expense, and I'll reimburse you for the cost of your ticket. And there's a reason for doing that, and it's not because I so admire James Bond, who he was just an arrogant guy, right? But the gadgets that he had were really an inspiration to some of the things that we would do within OTS. This goes back really to the spy fiction of the 1960s and the 1970s. Man from Uncle, Get Smart, the Avengers, the various spy-fi that was on TV and on the movies. What the fiction writers did was to understand that there were really interesting things that could be done in the gadget world. And what the OTS people did was would look at that and say, that really is a good idea. Now, can we bend the laws of physics to make that happen? And so things like the pen communicator, the cone of silence, these various gadgets that showed up in spy fiction and in the James Bond movies were often an inspiration to what our engineers and technical people can do. So my thanks to Desmond Llewellyn and all of the Bond franchise.
Well, that's a great tribute, and I think a fantastic point to end on, Bob. I really do appreciate your time with me today. There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.